back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, we're joined by someone I've really wanted to talk to for quite a long time, so I'm excited that she's here. That would be Jennifer Say. She's the Emmy-winning producer, U.S. national gymnastics champion, author, and former executive of Levi Strauss & Co. Jennifer Say also has Say Everything. That's a new newsletter on Substack about woke capitalism and standing up to groupthink. You also have a book coming out, Jennifer, in November, which I'm excited to read. You published an excerpt of that recently on Say Everything, your Substack. Thanks for joining Federalist Radio Hour.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Now, I imagine a lot of our readers encountered, you wrote this for Barry Weiss, right? After you left Levi, you wrote a piece about how everything went down. That was for Barry Weiss, right?
What essentially amounted to my resignation letter.
Right. So I think a lot of our readers probably saw that at the time, but if you could provide some background just on your life and your career and how you ended up at this moment in your career, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll give you the sort of top line version because they're linked. As a child, I was an elite gymnast, which is relevant to the story, and I'll explain how. I was a member of the national team for 7 years. As most folks now know, because of the Larry Nassar case, the sport is rife with abuse. He was the doctor for Team USA Gymnastics, but it's, you know, the coaches, the national team coaches, et cetera. And so despite the successes that I had in the sport, and I was the national champion, as you mentioned, a million years ago, back in 1986, I really struggled with the abuses, you know, well into my 30s. And ultimately, I wrote a book in 2008, which is sort of now considered an early whistleblower's account of the abuses. And the world, especially the gymnastics world and the Olympic movement, was not really ready to hear that yet. I was vilified, threatened with all sorts of craziness. But I persisted because I felt it was important to protect the children and the sport, and was ultimately sort of validated and vindicated. So that's kind of my childhood and even into adulthood. In my professional life, I worked at Levi's for close to 23 years. And I started as an entry-level marketing assistant and ended up as the brand president, which is, you know, was a huge honor. I love the brand since I was a kid, which I wrote about on the Substack for Barry. I traveled to Moscow in 1985 for the first ever, Goodwill Games. And I brought lots of Levi's to trade with the Russian gymnasts because they were like this symbol of American freedom and democracy. And you wanted to trade for like leotards and pins and sweats and stuff like that. And there was nothing better than Levi's to do that. So I had a long relationship with the brand. So it was a real honor to be, you know, appointed the president back in the fall of 2020. But that did all come to an end. I was outspoken about the harms to children from school closures during COVID. I lived in San Francisco at the time. California was the state that was closed the longest, 19 months of school closures. From the outset, I could see the harms that would be done. And then those harms were done. And I was told, I was asked, I was pleaded with to stop talking about it because it conflicted with the mainstream progressive narrative. And ultimately, I was told there wasn't going to be a place for me in the company any longer because they didn't say because my views were too contrarian, but that's what it was. and I think I was just too big of a risk because, you know, I was not obedient and I did not adhere to the narrative and I didn't stop talking about it even when I was told not to. So who knows what I was going to say, you know what I mean? I was just kind of risky. And, you know, I think what might be worth mentioning for your listeners is I come from the left. You know, that is kind of where I spent, you know, my whole life. I've been a registered Democrat since I could vote. I've never missed an election. And I still identify with a lot of the ideals that I thought the left was about. I thought the left should have taken the stance to protect public education and disadvantaged children in public schools. So I don't really feel that my values have changed all that much. I was just astonished at the response I got. I mean, I was absolutely demonized and vilified by my peers and my employees, people on my team, the social media sphere. And I kept going because I just knew that kids were being harmed. I couldn't stop myself despite the warnings. So I was pushed out of the company. I was told there wasn't a place for me, but I decided to quit on my own terms in a very public, bridge burning fashion. Because not only at that point, this was in February of this year, was I alarmed about the harm to children. I felt that the silencing that was happening and the censorship that was happening that we've all heard about on college campuses and is now very, very much the way of operating in companies across the country. I thought that needed to be discussed. And if I were to leave on their terms and accept severance, I would have to sign a non-disclosure agreement. And I was not willing to do that. So here we are talking about all this stuff.
Well, yeah, thank goodness you didn't do that, because there's so much insight to be gleaned, I think, from your experiences. And the lockdowns, it's such a bizarre line in the sand for the left for a million different reasons. It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. But before we kind of get into that, because I'm so eager to hear your explanations for where woke capitalism, sort of how it, where it comes from, why people have sort of subscribed to that doctrine. But would you say that being a sort of early whistleblower in U.S. gymnastics gave you the strength maybe to keep going amid all of the criticism when you stepped out and talked about something just completely different? And I mean, you're talking about public school lockdowns. Was it helpful to have gone to and weathered that first storm when the second one hit?
That's a great question. And I meant to make that connection. So yes, absolutely. Because for about 10 years, as I was speaking out about the abusive culture, the incredibly cruel and abusive culture, emotionally, physically, there's sexual abuse, as we now know, I thought everybody knew this. You know, I grew up in the sport. We all knew it. We just thought we weren't supposed to talk about it. So I was kind of stunned that the response was what it was from within my own community, because you know, they're calling me a liar. I knew they knew. They were subjected to the same treatment I was. But I persisted. The more objection, the more pushback I got, the more I knew I'd touched a nerve and it needed to be said. I needed to persist. And at first I was tentative, you know, I mean, it's all in there in the book, but when I would do media, I would say, oh, this is not an indictment of the sport. This is just my story. I mean, I was really in self-protection mode because the pushback was so tremendous. And this was in 2008. So it was like the early days of social media. I had no idea, you know, what trolls were. Like, I did not know how that was going to go down. I got used to it fast. And again, I became more bold as I progressed. But I think the way you stated it is absolutely correct. You know, ultimately, everyone came around to what I was saying. And so it just sort of validated for me that it kind of sucks to go first, but somebody has to go first. And there were so many young women who, as the Nassar story was breaking, wrote to me to say, you validated my experience. You gave me the strength to do this. And so I just knew that, you know, speaking out allows others to kind of screw up their courage and then do the same, because you're not alone then. And so I held that close as I was talking about schools. And while it is a discrete issue, it is still about children. And so, you know, the other thing that I held close was the fact that when I was a child in this abusive environment, I had no adults standing up for me. So, you know, that's what we owe our children. We owe them that protection. And to say, well, they're not complaining, or they're fine, or they don't tell you that, you know, children are very impressionable, as we know, and they're going to try to please the adults in their life. And if they're suffering, they won't necessarily say it. And then they internalize that and it becomes like this deep shame. And that's what ultimately drove me to write the book, because if you suffer, you think it's your fault because you're not supposed to talk about it. So it's this like endless horrible cycle of abuse. And so I just knew that kids were suffering with the school closures, and it seemed just so unempathetic to not be able to imagine a child, you know, a young child, for instance, left home alone to navigate Zoom school because their parents are hourly wage workers, or a high school student who disengages and fails and then drops out and doesn't graduate. Like, these are not rare stories. So I wanted to, I couldn't imagine that people weren't thinking about those kids, but they weren't. And so I wanted to, I don't want to say be their voice, because that's sort of, it's condescending, but I, you know, children are not, they're going to try to kind of go with the flow for the most part and kind of do what the adults tell them to do. And so it's our responsibility, I think, to protect children. That's why I kept talking about it. But the gymnastics experience absolutely gave me the kind of confidence that eventually people would come around, and I just had to kind of grin and bear it and persist in the meantime. I didn't think it would mean losing my job.
No, that's really interesting that you sort of knew that if you took the arrows, things would ultimately get better, because that was your experience earlier. That's actually really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I hoped, you know, and certainly I hoped it would happen before I lost my job, you know, somewhere during the 2 years of this, because it was about 2 years from when I started speaking out to when I lost my job. It was just a month shy. I was hoping it would happen during the time, and then everything would kind of be fine, because I liked my job. I loved my job. I loved the company. I loved the people I worked with. I love the brand. I wear the brand, you know. I'd worn it since I was a child. I really liked and respected the people that I worked with. And so I certainly hoped that the fever would break, you know, sooner than it had. And, you know, I don't think it's broken yet. I think we're starting to see some signs, and there are admissions that the school closures were unnecessary. There seems to be an unwillingness to point the finger at anyone. But someone did it. I mean, I know who it was. I think we need to get to the point where folks are held accountable, because, you know, the other kind of bit of feedback that happens now that frustrates me is, you know, people on the left are willing to say that this was unnecessary and it was harmful, but let's not point fingers. Well, this isn't about pointing fingers. This is about accountability, because it can't happen again. It cannot happen again. And kids are still very restricted. Kids are still the most restricted people in this country. Adults move freely and live their lives, and kids, both the very youngest, you know, 3 and 5 year olds and Head Start programs across the country are masked, and, you know, college students have booster mandates when companies across the country are lifting them. And so I this obsession with restricting children and young adults is just, you know, bananas to me. And we have to hold people accountable, because it can't happen again. They're the ones who are the most harmed by this.
And when people in C-suites are pondering, let's say they have a problematic executive like yourself who's speaking out, and they're sort of trying to figure out how this affects their bottom line, I always wonder in those conversations how much of this is genuinely a result of how they perceive consumer demand to be. Like, do they really, I know there have been some surveys that have circulated, especially in C-suites, about consumers wanting brands to speak out on politics. But there are also surveys that say people say that, but might not necessarily believe that. So I guess I'm wondering what the balance looks like from your experience when people are deciding to either take a woke stand in firing someone or do it proactively. Is this about what consumer demand actually is, what they think consumer demand is, or what they genuinely want to do out of the goodness of their own hearts? What's the balance look like?
There's a lot of questions in there. And if I don't get to some, you'll kind of, we'll keep conversing. So clearly I wasn't in the conversations where they were talking about what to do with me. So I was in the final conversation, but I was not in the kind of back room. I mean, I was in lots of backroom conversations. I was the president of the brand. I was, you know, number 2 or 3 in the company. But certainly not in the conversations that must have been like, oh goodness, what do we do about Jen? I was not in those. And when I realized they were happening at a regular clip, of course, at that point, I became concerned about my job, but that didn't stop me. I'll take myself out of it for a second and talk about, you know, how companies decide to take these political stances. And, you know, I'll talk first about Levi's. And here's, there's a line for me. Levi's has a long history of taking stands on behalf of their employees to take care of their employees, which I support. I'll give you a very clear example. In 1992, Levi's was the first Fortune 500 company to offer same-sex partner benefits. They also offered benefits to heterosexual partners that weren't married. So they basically created this equality for employees. Everybody got health care. No one's rights were taken away. Rights were given to all that made it equal. I support that. Now, if you were an employee that was anti-gay and you felt that that was wrong, you could say that, but you couldn't take somebody else's right away. So, you know, Levi's also desegregated factories in the South before the law required it. Mm-hmm. Again, that's about taking care of employees and treating employees equally. But sometime around the mid-2010s, companies, and Levi's is part of that, so this is not a Levi's specific thing, but a corporate, as all those young people from colleges, I think, graduate and go work at companies, they influence, I think, the culture in a significant way. And so we start having these conversations about, okay, do we make these stances public so that it's not just about our employees? Do we announce our long history of, you know, pro-LGBTQ equality? Do we sort of take that stance more publicly? And we decided, yes, to do that. And I will, you know, be very honest, I was part of that. I was definitely part of that. There was this push. And I think you're correct that there is a belief that this is what consumers are demanding. They want a brand and a company. They want to kind of put their dollars towards a company that they believe shares their values. But I think the inverse question in all these surveys is never asked. What if a company, you know, if you're asked the proactive question as a consumer, do you want to buy a brand that shares your values? You'll probably say yes. That's an easy, which is not predictive of how you'll actually behave, by the way. How you answer a question is not predictive of how you'll behave. Every marketer knows that. Will you buy this product if yes? That's not the same as buying it. Nobody's asked, though, what if the company just markets the products they sell? Are you less likely to? And see, that's the real question. And that, over the course of my tenure and in the last few years, is sort of what I was pushing for, because I felt it had gone so crazy, you know, and I did nothing in the last 2 years but kind of bat away emails from employees saying we need to take a stand on this, and we need to take a stand on this, and we need to fire this influencer because she said this. And it's mm-hmm. like, when are we going to market the jeans? At the end of the day, people still want a great quality product. And I think there's a lot of evidence, and I've written about this some on my Substack, that what people say is not what they will do. And I'll cite a competitor for a moment, if I might, the behemoth Nike, which is a brand that is probably, it's the largest apparel brand in the world. It is the most beloved. They have intense consumer loyalty. They make a big fuss every year during Women's History Month. International Women's Day is March 8th. Women's History Month is March, about celebrating women and women's equality and women this and women that. During the course of all of this celebrating of women, they have treated their own female employees with absolute disdain. And there's three very public examples of this. You know, female executives who delivered a dossier to the CEO talking about the harassment that went on for years in the company. You had an Olympian who, when she became pregnant, was forced to start competing again in order to get paid. And then you had a young Olympic hopeful who trained in their Oregon Nike running project, who was abused and harmed as a teenager to the point of suicidal ideation. So the women in their sphere, they aren't celebrating, they're harassing. These stories I just mentioned were all in the New York Times. They were not secret. They were on the front page of the New York Times, either in the business or sports section. No one cared. The company grew 8% while this was happening year on year. And so my point is, if you're going to take these stands, do it first in your own world and take care of the women and the people and, the, you know, your employees. Don't lie. It's a lie and it's a pose. And sorry, this is getting a little convoluted, but the fact that the consumers and the lovers of the Nike brand continued to buy it and bought the fanfare and the fake campaigns about celebrating women while they treated women poorly shows me no one really cares. And so I think companies would all be best served. And for me, the line is treat your employees with respect, treat them fairly, treat them all equally. They should all have the same right to free speech, for instance, which, you know, I did not, and make the best product you can and offer it at a fair price and market it in a way that's appealing.
It's fortuitous that you bring up the Nike example, because I was actually about to ask you about Nike. It's my understanding their work with Colin Kaepernick has sold like gangbusters. It's done really well for them. Meanwhile, Colin Kaepernick rails against capitalism as a practice, just philosophically rails against capitalism. And Nike is accused of having huge issues with their supply chains. Nobody cares. They say basically we are a Chinese company. That is a paraphrase of a quote of the CEO. Nobody cares at all. But there are these niches now that if you can successfully market to them, you know, Stephen Colbert has a huge audience, one of the biggest in late night, despite being super woke. Nike sold really well with the woke Kaepernick gear. But Levi's is such a, it's like quintessentially American brand, unifying. You mentioned bringing it to Moscow in the 90s and trading it. It seems like this idea or the ability to just appeal to everyone has, it seems to me like maybe that's impossible right now, because what you define at the, in the C-suite level in Manhattan or LA or wherever as equality or racism or bigotry or ignorance, like say on vaccine mandates or masking or lockdowns, is not a definition that's shared by the rest of the country.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and you had asked this in the prior question, and I didn't quite get to it, but I think in places like San Francisco, which is where Levi's is, Nike is in Portland. I mean, they have offices around the world, but the headquarters is Portland. They are bubbles. And so they think everybody agrees with them. And they think, and their employees are very loud, and their employees are pushing in this direction. But you and I know that the company is split. I mean, the country, not the company. The country is like almost divided 50-50. And so as far as you push this forward, you know, this woke view, which by the way is a lie,
yes.
Right?
There's that.
So that's the part that bothers me the most. And I want to come back to Kaepernick on that. You're alienating others. Although, you know, I will say this, they don't care either. You know, they'll burn their Nikes when Kaepernick is in the campaign, and then they go back and buy them anyway. So at the end of the day, what this is proof of to me, none of those sorts of boycotts last, you know, or they burned their New Balances back when I think the head of comms for New Balance had said something positive about Trump when he was first elected in 2016, and all these folks were, you know, burning New Balances on Instagram. And that was right before New Balance just took off as the like cool normie dad shoe. So those Brooklynites were the people buying them. And so really no one cares, which just says to me, reset yourselves and focus on what I would call normie capitalism, delivering a great product at a fair price and market it in a way that's appealing, because the other bits are a lie. And I'll give you the Colin example. And, you know, I was very close to this. Levi Stadium is in Santa Clara. You know, I was part of that deal. Colin, at the time when he started kneeling, played for the 49ers. I, and some of your listeners might disagree with this, but, you know, I'm not sort of currying favor with either side at the moment. I'm not going to start now. I'm fine with him kneeling. It's a peaceful protest. I don't care. You know, it's that was his using his voice. I support that. I support. Now, you know, some people might say, okay, but do it not on the job. That's on the job. Whatever. That's all in the past. At the time when he started it, we Levi's did not support it. And I said, we ran a campaign at the time, Use Your Voice. I was like, well, we don't have to kind of go all in, but we don't have to try to distance ourselves from him. We've told people, Use Your Voice. We've said that's not political. That's whatever you believe in, stand up for it. But now we're not supporting him. So there's the hypocrisy there, right? He was under contract with Nike when he started, and they distanced themselves. They sort of benched him as well. So they didn't support it until,
yes,
guess when? You know, when it was cool to support Black Lives Matter and kneeling and all of this. So everyone did it in an opportunistic way. Suddenly everybody supported Colin. And I think the timing of that campaign, because it came right on the heels of all this exposure of the way that women were treated in the company. So it was like a woke whitewashing, if you will. Mm-hmm. And look, they make great ads. They do it better than anybody else. They're moving. They're resonant, like, so people buy it. They're great filmmakers, but it's not real. They had benched him and distanced themselves from this man who was under contract when he started kneeling for several years. Right. So do they really support him? Anyway, these companies in San Francisco and Portland are in these bubbles. You know, San Francisco is left of center, which is what I always would have considered myself. And if you veer one tiny baby step outside of whatever the orthodoxy is of the moment, which constantly changes, so good luck keeping up, then you are suddenly an alt-right white supremacist because of one thing. I could agree on every other thing, but because I thought schools should open, and that's not what the Democratic Party was touting, that is not what Gavin Newsom was doing, then I was, you know, hiding my white hood in the closet. That is, I was a wolf in sheep's clothing. I had been lying and pretending all these years. What was that? What would be a point of that for me, to lie and pretend that I gotcha? I'm exposing, you know. So that's what's so frustrating. And you know, I think the same is true on the right. Like, you can't, this just notion of independent thought, and you have to kind of accept the whole orthodoxy from either side to be accepted by either side. And that's just not how, I don't think that's how most people think. You know, I think most people want to make decisions for themselves and may kind of mostly align, but not 100%.
It's definitely not how most people think. The purity tests are really alienating. I think that's really, really true. You write, this is in an excerpt from your book you published on Substack, "While Steve Jobs may now be known as kind of an asshole, he's also viewed as a visionary who changed the world. I can't tell you how many business leaders use his quote, 'stay hungry, stay foolish,' as their email signature sign off. It lends profundity and meaning to naked capitalism. CEOs and C-suite executives were always rich, but now they're rich, well-meaning, and beloved. It's not lost on me that I was included in this false idolatry." And in that piece, which again is an excerpt from your forthcoming book, you mention something fascinating, which is that there's this almost reflexive need to shake off the robber baron reputation, and to distance, like, that CEOs have this sort of chip on their shoulder, the robber baron chip on their shoulder, and they want to, you know, make sure people know they are not a Rockefeller, who actually was very charitable, but they are not a Rockefeller, and that actually sort of motivates some of this. Can you tell us more about that? It's such interesting insight.
Yeah, I think, you know, somebody asked me, Megan Dom, when I was on her podcast, asked me, like, yes, why are they doing this? And she sort of prompted me. I don't know that I thought about it that much. And I think the reasons are multifaceted, but I mean, it's insane to me that the left champions, you know, the heroes and communities, like, are these very, very rich, like crazy rich business leaders. Like, we've come to see them as these altruistic philanthropists. Make no mistake, they're in it to make a ton of money. Now, they want to convince you and I that that's not why, that they're in it to do good in the world. But more importantly, they want to convince themselves. They've convinced themselves as well. Let's be clear. They have convinced themselves, but I do believe somewhere deep, deep, deep down they know, and they will not let that be revealed. I think it all started kind of recently, honestly, in a meaningful way. It was like a response to Occupy Wall Street, I think, when you
Mm.
had this sort of wave of, you know, the banks being exposed as corrupt, which I don't know that is that surprising. And then you had, you know, the Sacklers and Purdue Pharma. And again, I don't think it's that surprising that, you know, pharma, big pharma has been exposed as wanting to make money. I mean, the fact that they would go to the lengths that they did and actually ignore this widespread addiction and overdosing, I think is shocking to say the least, but there's a long history of it in the industry. And so I think that corporate leaders, they want to distance themselves from the robber barons of the past and the more recent, you know, robber barons, the Enrons and the Sacklers and, you know, and all of that. And then they also have children who influence them. And
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's much written about that kids and parents, parents of Gen Zs, and I have two, they have very different relationship with their kids than many years ago. You know, they like to be friends, not parents. And so they want to be cool to their kids. They don't want to be robber, but greedy robber barons to their kids either, although they still want to give them every benefit that that affords the child, including sometimes paying for someone to take the SAT for them if they, if that child can't get in to the university that is considered acceptable. And so it's this weird dynamic. And I do think these leaders, and I cite CEOs specifically, but it's C-suite, as you mentioned, they want to present this burnished image of, you know, I may be rich, but I'm a do-gooder, or I am a do-gooder first. Oh, I just happen to be rich because I'm so good at what I do. And they are sitting around the dinner table with their kids who went to woke private schools and woke colleges who, and have been told, these children, everything that comes out of their mouth is of the utmost importance, and they always get a medal, and they should get promoted as soon as they step foot in the building, and they are incredibly worthy. And so, and now you have them, you know, in droves in companies across the country. And so these leaders have the opportunity to curry favor, not just with their own children, but their kids' cohort. And I'll add one more point, if I may, they don't understand social media.
Another question I wanted to ask, because it seems like as soon as the hordes start developing on social media, there's this perception in C-suites, CEO level, that that is representative more broadly of the population, when it really isn't.
Yeah. And the weird thing is it's true and it's not, right? So for the kids themselves, they know the power of social media. They know that from a university classroom, they can tweet something out or take a photo and post it on Instagram or Snap and say something about the professor, because maybe she used the wrong term for something. Maybe she said, hey guys, and you're not allowed to say that anymore. But she's my generation and we grew up saying that. So they know the power of that. And they know that can launch university investigations. They know that can get professors in all kinds of trouble. So I'm torn on this one, because it's not real and it is real. You know, my trouble started on social media, and
yes,
it could have been ignored and left there, but I lost my job in real life because of what happened on social media. So
do you think some of that was the pipeline from social media to actual media? So in that, like, the media, social media hordes can gin up very real coverage in media, which is then obviously becomes a public relations problem for the company.
They can. In my instance, that did not happen. It was all imagined. It was all sort of fear of what might happen. And to come to the other point, I mean, I think I'm a rarity for my age cohort in my use of social media. And I mean, I was the chief marketing officer for Levi's for 8 years. Like, I understand the power of social media. I know how to use it. My peers mostly didn't and don't. You know, they might post pics of the kids on Facebook for their friends, you know, who are in their age cohort. And that's not ginning up any controversy, you know, mm-hmm. for the most part. And so, you know, and my boss, the CEO, I don't think used any social media. Like, he might look over his wife's shoulder to see what his daughter's doing on Snapchat, but he didn't understand it. And so when his corporate communications leader is presenting to him what she's seeing on Twitter, and it might be one troll that, you know, is trying to get me fired, there's no context. It's a page with a comment with maybe, you know, 4 likes or maybe 100 likes. But It reads as a page, just like it might read as a page as if it were the New York Times. There's no sort of context setting, and I think everybody gets kind of hysterical. And I love Dave Chappelle's line that Twitter's not a real place. Like it's not a real place, and if you ignore it, it usually just kind of sinks like a stone. If you panic, it becomes a real life problem. And I think a good example of this is the Chappelle incident on Netflix and the CEO of that company. And I know the Netflix stock has been a little bit rocky. I don't think it's because of Chappelle. I think it's because people are finally leaving their houses and doing things and not watching Netflix all day. But there was a staged walkout by employees in response to the Chappelle special, The Closer, where that was deemed anti-trans. It was not a lot of employees. It was a handful of employees. And they continued to protest. And the CEO said, if you don't accept that we're a platform that's going to air a lot of content with a lot of different points of view, then maybe this is not the place for you to work. He didn't endorse the content. He just said, basically, he said, we're about free speech. And if you don't support that, then maybe don't work here. And guess what? Crickets. It all went away. Yeah. And so I just think most lack the courage. And I don't want to, it's not that he's such a principled person. I mean, I don't know much about him. It was the most popular thing they've run in years. It won awards. And so, I think it was business that drove him. And I think to come back to the earlier point, he recognizes that everyone watches Netflix, right, left, red state, blue state, and they need to offer content for everyone. And the irony in all of this is Levi's is this democratic brand, but for a fashion brand, if you're going to kind of put them in that category, it actually leans tilts slightly more red state or right in terms of the actual consumer base.
Right.
And so why not adopt a strategy that embraces everyone? And for some time that actually was the strategy. No matter who you are, no matter what you think, no matter what your style is, we're all connected. We're all connected in our differences. That was the strategy, not anymore. Now it's if you don't believe this, you're not welcome to work here. And I don't think they'd ever say, and we certainly never said you're not welcome to buy Levi's, but that's the message sent. Now, it has not affected the business. The business is still strong. So.
And yeah, it seems if anything, Levi's has become increasingly popular because of the broader trends in fashion, normcore, and all of that stuff. And I also wanted to ask, you've written about the girl boss, and actually in this excerpt I keep referencing, you talk about Elizabeth Holmes. And as I was thinking about your biography, it's very clear to me that you are the quintessential girl boss. You have endured so much, you rose through the ranks. And I'm curious as to what you would say about that kind of image that was created, especially the glossy mags jumped in on it and elevated a whole lot of corporate women, successful corporate women. What's the disconnect, I guess, between what a girl boss should be, and how it was sort of presented as looking in the media and in the business culture?
Well, I'm obsessed with Elizabeth Holmes and that whole story because as if you I just for years I have been, I've read every piece of content, I watch everything because I'm obsessed with this idea of how these lies get sold.
It's a
I
powerful
don't understand.
people in her case. You have Schultz being bought in, the Murdochs. I mean, everyone was buying this.
Everybody bought in. Everybody wanted to believe, that she was this altruistic, tech, smart, young, attractive female leader. We all wanted one. And so we bought what they were selling. And the media obviously was complicit and put her on every cover and believed every line of bullshit, frankly, that she spewed. And what's so like astonishing to me is if you go back and watch all the old footage of her, which of course I do because I'm crazy, she seems just like a kook the whole time. Like to me, she's utterly unconvincing. And you can say, oh, that's hindsight. But I was sort of stunned in the moment too. And there are great female leaders to support and further help. It wasn't her. I don't get why we picked her. And so, what is a real girl boss. I don't even like the term. Someone who's good at their job. I
Right.
mean, at the end of the day, that's what it has to be.
Right.
It's someone, you know, and it's the same time frame, you know, the Elizabeth Holmes and the Sandberg, Sheryl Sandberg, I think, they were both kind of celebrated as these feminist hero icons. And, you know, Holmes, at least, I mean, she's been convicted on 4 counts of fraud. She's going to spend time in prison, I suspect. And I think Sandberg's legacy is questionable at best at this point.
Yes.
I think there are experts and elites. We wanted to believe and embrace the story, right? There was so much written about tech bro culture, which is still predominant in Silicon Valley. And they wanted to prove their woke bona fides. They wanted to prove it wasn't a tech bro misogynistic culture. And so look, here's this perfect specimen. Let's all celebrate Elizabeth Holmes. And she was able to con people with loads of money because they bought that story. I do think it's interesting that her whole board, which was filled with, you know, stars, none of them were from biotech. None of them understood this industry. Like, those people all rejected it. And yet you had this utterly incurious media who were also desperate for this female superhero to prove that we all were woke enough to have one. The messed up part is that there are great female leaders. Like, why pick them? And again, it has to start with, is she good at her job? The actual real thing, the actual real work of the job, delivering a product that works at the right price, making it appealing for people, explaining it to people so they understand it, managing a business with discipline, which clearly Elizabeth Holmes was not able to do. It has to start there. It's just not that complicated, you know? Don't lie to people. Don't sell something that you don't make, and don't sell yourself in a false way. That's it.
Yeah. Well, and this question I really am curious about, because there's a critique of Americans, and this is a kind of a marketing question, but I think I'm curious to see if it connects to woke capital from your perspective. It's not meant to be a leading question. I'm genuinely curious. There's this critique of Americans as being very materialistic, and I think that's really fair to an extent. And some people look back on, you know, how we operated during the Cold War and say, you know, there's this mythology that it was the Levi's, that it was David Hasselhoff, that really, you know, this was what brought down the wall, and this is what helped sell democracy and helped sell sort of Americanism, export it to corners of the world that were not enjoying the same freedoms. And some people criticize that now and say, well, are we just selling rank materialism? Are we really just selling McDonald's and jeans? And it strikes me that I think it's like Target sells shirts right now that just have the Levi's red tag on them, which I think is awesome. I actually bought one. But there's something that's happening right now, and it's happened in different periods of American fashion, that there's this obsession with the brand label. You know, you want the Ralph Lauren polo guy on your polo that makes the polo dramatically different in America, or the Lacoste gate, or like, it's just totally different. Does that in some way, do you think, influence any consumer demand? Maybe like the people who rushed to buy Kaepernick material in America, that because we do identify so deeply with our brands and we literally wear our brands, that it's created this sort of emotional connection to them that does demand, you know, altruism or even the appearance of it?
I'm still working through some of this, you know, and, you know, the shirt you're talking about, the Levi's shirt with the red logo on it, the Batwing, that's what we called it. You know, I believed for many years, I mean, that t-shirt made our t-shirt business, you know, that is what grew our t-shirt business from $500 million to $1 billion. And I believe because of the simplicity of that t-shirt, it really is just the brand mark. It had to be that people were buying it because that mark represented values that they identified with. I don't believe that now. I think the brand was cool. We made the brand cool because, you know, amidst all the social justice stances we took, we also went to Coachella and we worked with people like, you know, Snoop Dogg and Alicia Keys and Chance the Rapper and, you know, we aligned the brand with popular culture and it became cool again. It became relevant again. At the end of the day, people buy Jordans and they obsess over Jordans, whether they like Jordan 4s or 3s or 1s and what's the best year, because they love Jordans and because Michael Jordan is the best basketball player that ever played. You know, don't tell LeBron. at the end of the day, I mean, my 8-year-old, he doesn't even know what brands are, but he asks about Jordans because he's seen Space Jam. Like, he loves Michael Jordan.
That's awesome.
So I think that the sort of first part in answer to your question is, I think people buy clothes. I'll speak about apparel. You know, it isn't a very image-based category. At the end of the day, I'll give you another good example. Our women's jeans business at Levi's had always been, you know, quite small compared to the total market and compared to our total men's. That's not true anymore. At the end of the day, women want to buy jeans that make their butts look cute, and they did not think we had those. Now, we had to have a marketing campaign that spoke to them and that was relevant to them. But at the end of the day, where the rubber hit the road was when she put them on. Did she think that she looked her very best? And did she feel confident that she did? It all comes down to the product. So I think that it would serve us all well to kind of get back to that. Are we selling rank materialism? Probably a little bit, you know. I don't have any numbers in front of me, but like, you know, all the fast fashion brands, for the most part, when I say fast fashion, I'm talking, you know, H&M, Zara, those are all European brands. Mm-hmm. Those are the brands that change the way we purchase. Those are the brands that said you need a new outfit every time you go out. Not Levi's. Levi's have a lifetime guarantee, literally a lifetime guarantee. So those European brands are encouraging. Now they're unbranded. So, you know, it's more about get the style that was on the runway yesterday, wear it, even though it feels scratchy like paper, and throw it out and then buy another one. But that's what drives, you know, rank consumerism. So I don't think it's a distinctly American characteristic or quality. Now, Russia, they couldn't get goods outside of Russia, you know, when the wall was up. And so this idea, they associated Levi's, and, you know, in broken English, we were able to talk about this a little bit, with the West and cowboys and, you know, the word I would, rugged individualism. So they very much did associate the brand with that, and that was unavailable to them. And I will say, I'll add one more point. You know, I traveled to China a lot in the last, well, not the last 2 years, but before that, because of our business there. And I was able to do in-home research at one point, and I was went to a guy's apartment, this apartment in Beijing, I believe is where we were. We didn't realize until about halfway through that he actually spoke really good English. Like, we were chatting with each other, and he was like, that's not. But he had a VPN line just so he could buy Levi's off eBay.
Wow.
He said, I want the real ones. Wow. He didn't believe that the ones he was getting in China were the real Levi's, which they are. He wanted the real ones. And this is a strange story. He had a Confederate flag hanging in his apartment, in his like one room apartment. And we started chit-chatting about why that would be. Why would this Chinese guy in Beijing? And he heard us and understood us. And he said, it's not about, he literally said this, it's not slavery, it's freedom.
Huh.
And so to him, and he didn't have the whole story right, you know, about the American history, nor should he, but to him, American values were very much about freedom, about free speech, and to some extent, free capitalism. You know, it was about being, it was about individual rights. And he was able to express that pretty succinctly. This is 3 years ago that I was in China. And so I think that the values of the West, as epitomized by the US, are still, you know, believed in to some extent, even if we don't always live them. You know, we have the potential to.
That's amazing. And it's what's, I think, so upsetting when you see Nike saying we're essentially a Chinese company, because from that perspective, it does, you know, recall that a lot of what they're selling in China is Americanism. There is something about that. There's something about an American brand that's appealing. And so to dilute the brand, it doesn't even maybe seem like a long-term strategy for success if that's such a part of why people are interested in the product.
Yeah, I think that's true. And you know, we talked about that a lot at Levi's. I mean, we didn't sell Americanism in the, like, there weren't flags waving in the advertising. It wasn't that, like you used to see for Tommy Hilfiger or something like that. But we did believe in sort of the very best of, this is ironic now, so you can laugh if you want, but like the very best of what American values represent around the world, you know, the notion of inclusion and freedom of speech, and we're all different, but we're connected, and progress, you know, this notion of progress. Levi's was founded in California. You know, Levi Strauss moved from Germany to forge a better life for himself and his family. Like the notion of progress, which is still, I think, in some ways represented by California, if you think about, you know, Silicon Valley, and, you know, we can agree or not agree, but like this idea of progress the West has represented, and that's a very American ideal as well. And so we were very conscious of that, the notion of inclusion, especially. But apparently, I was a bridge too far to be included. And so, and you know, I do want to say, I think Levi's is caught up in the maelstrom of this. I don't think they're particularly bad. I mean, it's a huge bummer for me that I don't get to work there anymore. I just think they're part of the larger problem. And I think that leaders need to have the courage to just say, we are very much about inclusion. Our consumers, we welcome everyone, our employees, you must be respectful to each other in these four walls, but you're all free to believe what you believe and to say so outside of work. I just don't see why that's not possible. Yeah, I was doing an interview the other day, like a job interview. and I was asked, do you regret anything you did? And I said, no, because I believe in these values and this principle. And I don't think I signed my rights away as a citizen just because I work in a company. And I certainly don't believe that because I'm a senior leader in a company that I signed my rights away. And I said exactly what I just said to you. Why can't we say everybody's welcome? Be respectful. If you're not respectful to your peers, you don't get to stay. If you say something horrible and mean and degrading and you don't treat people with respect, but you're free to express your opinions and to go to rallies and do whatever you want to do outside. You're a citizen. And she said that won't work. You can't have that in the world today because the world doesn't work that way. And I said, well, I reject that because the world can work that way, but some of us have to be brave enough to say that it's going to.
Last question then, are consumers pushing these corporations in a better direction? Or is that relationship fundamentally broken because it's such a monolithic ideology in the C-suite world that they're sort of going to push this no matter what? They're in the bubbles that we were talking about earlier. But is there, you know, like Ted Sarandos, he saw people wanted to watch Chappelle's special. He put out the statement. He told his employees what he told them. Are we moving in a direction where that becomes normal again, or is that still up in the air?
I think it's up in the air, and I think it's employees pushing even more than consumers. You know, I think brands that didn't take a stand on whatever issue of the day, no one's talking about them, not really. No one's saying, hey, I don't know who, think of whatever brand you want.
Yeah. Hardee's never put out a BLM statement, yeah.
Yeah, hey, Arby's, why didn't you make a comment about, you know, the overturning of Roe versus Wade? Like, nobody cares, and so I think they get swept up in the moment, and there is a lot of pressure from employees. There's a lot of pressure from employees. And it requires some degree of courage to say, we hear you. Again, we're going to make sure you're taken care of. And, you know, we support reproductive health care rights for our employees, and we pay for them if that's what you want to do. But we're not going to talk about this publicly. We're going to talk about the new product launch we have coming. That's what we're going to do. We're not going to say we're for it or against it. We're going to say we have this new product because that's what people want from us. And I do, in my heart of hearts, I believe that would work, but no one said that because it is overwhelming, the employee pressure. And again, they want to be cool and they want to be seen as altruistic philanthropists and they want their kids to like them. And it's all these personal dynamics that drive it as well. And I don't think it's required. I don't think business would suffer if you didn't take a stance. I think that the companies, it would have this other benefit is you would be focused on the business. Right. You would make better products. The thing that frustrated me in my last year was I didn't have time to focus on the core of what my job was because of all this other stuff. You have limited bandwidth. You have limited money to advertise products. So I think that kind of focus would make businesses better as well. The last thing I would say is there's a side benefit to encouraging speech amongst your employees as well, because in corporate cultures where employees know that they can't challenge leadership, they also end up making very poor business decisions, you know. And I've cited some brands like Abercrombie and Fitch, which was a very guru-led culture, Victoria's Secret. All the decisions were made by one or two key decision makers. They didn't listen to employees who sounded the alarm that this way to market the brand was not relevant anymore. They wouldn't listen. Guru-led cultures do not work for very long. And, you know, in some instances, real corruption happens, like with Enron. And so you need to create a culture where people feel comfortable speaking up. You know, I always said great ideas can come from anywhere. And I really believe that. And I tried to create a culture where everyone's voice was heard. It is ironic that mine was the one that was too problematic. But so I think there's all kinds of benefits, you know, I think there are a lot of business benefits as well to creating a culture where people feel free to speak up.
I've never heard anyone make that point in this conversation, and it seems like such an obvious one. So that's very interesting. Thank you, Jennifer Say, so much for your time. You've been very generous with your time and your insights and your candor. It's greatly appreciated.
It's really nice to talk to you.
So you can check out Say Everything on Substack. That's Say with an E, S-E-Y. Make sure to do that and make sure to watch out for Jennifer's forthcoming book. That'll be out in November. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious. Bye.